Hello and welcome to the Insider's Insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we look inside the secret world of spying and intelligence agencies. Then, on the Scholar Circle, as we head into the fourth Republican presidential primary contest, we'll explore why people vote the way they do. The inner workings of intelligence gathering agencies has long been a sort of black box to the American public. How many are there? How do they cooperate and function? How have they changed? And what reforms are needed? Glenn Carl served 23 years in the clandestine services of the Central Intelligence Agency, working four continents and in Washington, D.C. His last position was as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats on the National Intelligence Council, where he was responsible for strategic analysis of terrorism, international organized crime, and narcotics. His just-released book, The Interrogator, explores doubt that he faced with his most serious assignment, where he interrogated who was thought to be one of the most senior al-Qaeda detainees. You were with the agency 23 years. Maybe a good place to start would be how you experienced the agency change over those 23 years.
Oh, dramatically. Not too long after I retired in 2007, I was on a panel. And the first question, it was a woman, a junior officer, and she said, "Mr. Carl, what was the single biggest change you noticed in the CIA from the beginning to the end of your career?" No question in my mind, and that is the changed role of women. When I started in the mid-80s, early mid-80s, in the Directorate of Operations, there were a few, very few, senior females, and they had to be really, really tough because they would have been steamrolled. There were junior officer females, peers of mine at that time, just starting. And otherwise, to put it somewhat crudely, but not too inaccurately, women were viewed as support staff or there for the pleasure of the men who did the real work.
What else did you see change? Did it grow? Did it shrink? Did the focus move?
Oh, many times the focus changed. I mean, of course, the agency will reflect broader changes in the society. So also, when I first started, if one were homosexual, one would be fired or prosecuted. And then midpoint in my career, so 15 years ago, I would guess, the laws changed and the regulations, I think because of President Clinton. And now to be gay is irrelevant and routine. So the agency's changed sociologically that way too. There are types of intelligence work that become the in thing and they rise and fall over time. So the paramilitary work of the CIA was very important when I first began in the mid-80s, and that's because of two things, largely. The effort to defeat the Soviets in Afghanistan and the war with the Sandinistas and the Contras. And so those were in subjects, and there was a huge focus then on paramilitary Special Activities Division work. When the Cold War and those wars ended or petered out, then the paramilitary activities were no longer in vogue and the resources were redirected towards the traditional work of the agency again, which is human intelligence collection.
When you say human, you mean on particular individuals?
Convincing individuals to spy for the United States. So I would approach an individual and say, "Have I got a deal for you?" That's the heart and soul of the CIA's job. Special activities, paramilitary work, those are sexy things.
In the business. Paramilitary work, you mean recruiting the paramilitaries to work on behalf of?
No, not necessarily. People who are highly trained, very impressive professionals in military skills. So if we are supporting the Mujahideen in their war against Afghanistan, the fact that I studied Thucydides in French is not directly relevant to the task. But if you're a special operations veteran, your skills are directly relevant to helping our allies in their effort against the Soviets. So that's paramilitary work. There are other things too. When the Berlin Wall fell and the Cold War ended, then the central mission historically of the CIA ended, which was the Soviets. And we had to redirect again. And for a time, there was a debate, a search for, well, what is our raison d'etre? What's the mission now? And so is it economic intelligence? Is it political intelligence? What? George Tenet in the mid-90s, I think, saved the Directorate of Operations by reinvigorating and focusing resources once again on human intelligence collection. 6 years later, in 2001, of course, 9/11 occurred, and once again, paramilitary work as relevant to counterterrorism operations became the prime focus of where people wanted to go because you always want to be the pointy end of the spear.
How did changes in the administration affect the CIA?
It's tremendously influential.
Give us some examples. You were there 23 years. That's a long time.
Well, yes, unfortunately. Or fortunately. When I started my career, Bill Casey was the director, and he was a veteran of the OSS in World War II. So for him, bureaucracy and the rules were hindrances and irritations, and he found the agency culture to get in his way.
Because the agency
followed the rules and had procedures, and part of the rules are to obey the laws. And he was mission-oriented, one could say, and he wanted to get the Sandinistas, and don't be a hidebound bureaucrat for me when I'm telling you that that's the mission. Arguably, that attitude led to Iran-Contra. When the directors changed, so did the culture. John Deutsch was focused on technical intelligence. He thought that satellites were important. And of course, everyone, these are all shades of degree, but he also thought that human intelligence was slow, outdated, and done very poorly by the CIA. So he was open in his denigration of the Directorate of Operations and Human Intelligence Collection, which was the historic core of CIA's mission and heart of its culture. So he was not highly regarded by many of his subordinates. And then it changed again. So the director is critical, very influential in our attitudes, as is presidential administration.
Because the presidential administration would appoint the director.
In part because of that, but also because of the administration's focus and the issues to which it will have to respond. So George Bush II was obviously seized with 9/11 and counterterrorism, and that became the central activity of the Central Intelligence Agency and the administration for the 8 years of the Bush administration. The administration would argue that that was a response to necessity. One could argue otherwise, that it was a choice. But whatever the answer to that issue, the fact is that the agency follows the guidance and does the bidding of the executive, and the executive wanted counterterrorism as a priority, and so that's what it was.
In terms of the other intelligence agencies, is there a relationship, and how does it work, if so?
To answer that would be the work of multiple books. The relations are intimate, ongoing, 25 hours a day, all the time, among all the now 17 agencies of the intelligence community.
17.
17, right.
Can you name some of them?
Oh, sure. Well, there's the CIA, everyone knows about. There's the National Security Agency, which does electronic intelligence, picking up radio conversations and so on. There's the National Geospatial Agency that does satellite observation. There is the Bureau of Intelligence and Research in the Department of State that does analysis. There's the Defense Intelligence Agency that is a military copy of the Central Intelligence Agency, which was explicitly created by Robert McNamara so that the Secretary of Defense would not have to be beholden to an agency not under his control. And that has continued. One could argue that there is a lot of redundancy, but the counterargument is that different opinions working on the same issue provide perspectives that are complementary. Then there's Marine Corps Intelligence Agency and the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, and so on. The core intelligence agencies are CIA, DIA, NSA, INR, Defense Intelligence Agency, State Department Intelligence and Research. So they're huge, and they work together in an infinite number of ways all the time. They do operations together overseas. They do analysis together or as constructive rivals on any issue.
Then say the CIA was working on an issue, say, in Afghanistan. You also have Army intelligence there. Do you have FBI there also?
The FBI is overseas in many countries, so it's quite possible they would be there, yes. Let me give a concrete example. Let's say the president wants to know what's happening in Waziristan, the ungoverned border area between Pakistan and Afghanistan. The question would go to the National Intelligence Council, where I was the deputy national intelligence officer for terrorism, essentially. And I would call together to chair a meeting of the intelligence community. Each of the 17 agencies would send a representative, and I would say, the president has asked us to assess what's going on in Waziristan. And I would then dole out or coordinate how the responses would be prepared. I'd say, I need your respective assessments in 3 days. And they would send them to me, and then we would hash out. I would put it together in some sort of a coherent structure, and then we would hash it out. And I would say, okay, NSA says there is nothing happening, and CIA says that they have 400 nuclear weapons there. What's the truth? How do we answer? What do we do? And you hash it out. So you work together analytically all the time. Also, my experiences are typical. That's why the examples are useful. I was an operations officer for most of my career, meaning that I conducted operations to penetrate terrorist organizations overseas. And I worked intimately with the FBI on any number of cases. And I worked with the military on cases. And they brought their operational perspectives and expertise, as I did as a CIA officer, together to say, well, you know, I can pick the lock here, or I know how to speak that language, and we'll do this thing together.
You mentioned earlier about the Iran-Contra scandal, and there were quite a few convictions in that. And you've also described in your book this sort of gray, having to choose between unethical and unethical, essentially, or borderline ethical. And I wonder, when you look at Iran-Contra, can you put that into a context of the kind of gray area that you found yourself working in?
Oh, I can directly and firsthand, because it is a precursor experientially for me and should have been for the agency and our government of what I lived in the global war on terror. The gray area, well, I'll give an example. One of my superiors when I was working on Iran, I never worked in Iran, on Contra-Sandinista issues, was sent to Central America. And the Boland Amendment had made it illegal for the United States, therefore the CIA, to provide lethal aid to the Contras. Well, that's the law. His job was to work with the Contras in circumstances in which the men with whom he worked were going off into combat routinely. And he was forbidden to arm them, but his orders were to have them conduct these missions. So that was a dilemma for him, because he didn't really want to send people unarmed, most likely to their deaths. And he had to decide what to do. And what he chose to do, unbeknownst to anyone else, was he provided them lethal aid. And that came out, and he was charged. And as I recall in testimony, a senator asked him, sir, are you aware of the Boland Amendment that outlawed that? And he said, yes, sir, I am. Did you provide lethal aid, sir? And he said, yes, sir, I did. And he said, how can you explain having knowingly broken the law, given your oath? And he said, sir, I don't know what things are like where you come from, but where I come from, you don't send people off to their deaths without giving them at least a chance to defend themselves. And I think one can only sympathize with the dilemma that he confronted, and he chose a path that was illegal. But he was in a terrible dilemma, and arguably you could say it was a clear issue that he can't break the law, but I think it was a gray moral crisis where no choice was the right one for him.
How often is that before you or your colleagues?
Something as stark as that, a life and death situation of war and clear legal obligations that one breaks, is rare. And that's an extreme example. I knew that man well. He's a fine man. More typical is a morally gray issue where your job is to get someone to commit treason. And to do that, you have to play upon that individual's deepest hopes and win his deepest trust, or hers, and then use that trust to serve the ends of the United States, which are not necessarily good for the individual, but that is the job. So there is a constant tension between the need to manipulate to accomplish your mission and your effort, which will be sincere also, to be of good faith to the man whose trust you are winning.
You said that you had to break laws, steal, lie about almost everything, and exploit people to do your job.
That's the job. I was going to say a paradox, but it is an exceptional challenge, morally, intellectually, and psychologically, to win someone's trust sincerely. And to do the job right, you really have to. People see through falsity more often than one would imagine. So you do want to be a good friend to this person, the angel of his hopes. And
that had to create cognitive dissonance.
For many, I think it does, and many officers, well, few people suited psychologically to do the job, and the agency does a good job of sifting, and then people early in their career will sift themselves, because it is a strange series of paradoxes that one lives all the time. Those who can work out how to compartment your simultaneously shared but contradictory emotions and moral obligations become good officers, and those who don't will leave. But dissonance, I don't know if I felt cognitive dissonance. I became good and at ease psychologically with my job, but it took a while to learn, because also paradoxically, but sensibly, the agency seeks to hire people of high moral rectitude who are deeply principled. And that is a contradiction with the obligation to manipulate others' deepest principles in a Machiavellian way. But that's the job.
So how many officers are there at a time in the CIA operating like this?
Well, that I can't say. That's a classified number. But I think I can say the general public will imagine that the CIA is everywhere. And certainly foreigners imagine that every time a traffic light goes out in La Paz, Bolivia, that it's the dark hand of the CIA is behind it. And we would always joke and think, well, if only. In fact, the CIA is shockingly small, or the Directorate of Operations, shockingly small. People, I don't think, would believe how few of us there are. And it's typically our errors are those events that are discussed. But I think the agency and its personnel do, on the whole, remarkable work, given the resources that are spread really pretty thin.
There's a section in your book where you're describing what you went through, particularly with regards to this person who was the suspected high-level al-Qaeda person. And you said some call it torture, but you didn't yourself call it torture in the book.
Did I not? Maybe I didn't.
Do you consider it torture?
The simple answer is yes. Certainly the Bush administration and the agency worked hard to muddy the waters on that. And it is true that no one in the agency acted without direct authorization. I'm confident of that. And the authorization came from the president. And we were told that the president had consulted with the Department of Justice to verify that all actions that were ordered and authorized were legal. And the agency was explicit, people above me, the senior levels of the agency, that it received clear legal guidance and authorization before doing anything. All of that is true. It's also true, however, that the guidance received was a hackwork bit of political flimflammery written by a political appointee that had nothing to do with 800 years of Western history and 250 years of American history, that didn't even make a mockery. It simply destroyed a habeas corpus, trial by jury, rules of evidence, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the Convention Against Torture, the Geneva Conventions, the Executive Order 12333, which guides CIA officers' operations, and was clearly in contradiction with them all. So was it legal or illegal? One can argue, if one is a casuist, that it is both. You know, morally, the spirit of our laws and the clear laws and regulations we had, the actions that we engaged in are at the very least unacceptable.
It seems to me that you wrote this book partly because of that experience seeming wrong to you and the administration's particular directive.
Oh, you don't need any qualifiers whatsoever. I wrote the book because I was terribly distressed, shocked, but sincerely shocked. I'm not the Casablanca pretense here, and deeply, deeply concerned as an American citizen, that I was one of the few people who has firsthand knowledge and experience in what we did to ourselves and how gravely and egregiously we undermined and contravened the principles, regulations, practices, spirit, and letter of our laws and our society. And if I didn't write about this, I would then be a tacit cover-upper, and I wouldn't do it. That this, to me, what we did and what we have done to ourselves is as grave a crisis with as deep an impact on American laws, institutions, and society as anything that the United States has done since the internment of 110,000 Japanese Americans because their eyes slant only, that's the only reason, or since My Lai, or since McCarthyism.
Do you think most of your colleagues are on the same page as you?
I think most of my colleagues were profoundly disturbed about the impossible choices and dilemmas in which the CIA and its officers were placed. And there is always a bell curve of response to any specific action or circumstance. But generally, overall, the bell curve, all but maybe one or two standard deviations on the extreme, shared deep concern about what we were doing and what we did to ourselves. And our job is to do the hard tasks that are unclear as to whether they work or are right, but are ordered and we are assured are legal and in the national interest.
So in the 23 years you were with the agency, was this the first time that you felt this level of disturbance?
Oh, certainly. As I said, I worked on the Contra Sandinista War. I worked on the kidnapping of American officials, the CIA chief, and American civilians in Lebanon. I did counterterrorism work. I recruited people to commit treason. That was my day-to-day job for 23 years. There was nothing not remotely, as disturbing or that has raised as grave issues about American society and our government as the enhanced interrogation program and the misperceptions and delusions of the war on terror. Nothing remotely like it.
And where does the line get crossed? How does it get from this is okay to this is awful?
The agency and its officers take our oaths really very, very seriously, to the point of sacrificing your devoting our lives to it. And the oath is to preserve and protect the Constitution of the United States, uphold its laws, and serve the national interest. And the national interest can be ruthless, but it can never be to traduce the values and the laws that we are sworn to protect and the interests we're sworn to advance. And so when you have clear laws, the Convention Against Torture, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and you have all the checks and balances of our general counsel's office in every sub-bureau of the agency and the government and the Department of Justice and the general counsel's office and the director of the CIA's office and in the White House, and you have oversight committees and on, and you have all of these measures to guide and make sure that our practices and actions are acceptable and serve the national interest, and all of them fail because of the work of or the actions of about a half dozen people, so that our laws no longer protect us and our regulations and oversight practices no longer protect us, and our officers take actions that undermine the Constitution and habeas corpus and don't protect us. This is terrifying, because our government is then no longer a government of laws. And to say it sounds crazy, that doesn't happen in America, but it did. I lived it. And that is very frightening. And then even worse is that not only did it happen, but it happened with the broad, although innocent and ignorant, support of the American people, who had been told, we are protecting you, we are doing things that are necessary, it's okay. And the people said, well, okay, that's right. And that's right then accepted practices that undermined our laws. And that is really shocking.
You retired before President Obama took office, but I imagine you still have a sense of if things have changed back.
Well, I know that they changed quite a bit back. John Brennan is President Obama's National Security Advisor for Terrorism on the National Security Council. And I know John well, and I think very highly of him. He has a quite sophisticated view of the nature of the terrorist threat and a sophisticated and deep understanding of and commitment to our laws in spirit and practice and letter. And I know for a fact the paradigm that shapes our sense of the nature of the terrorist threat and the actions that we can take to counter it is radically different now than it was under the previous administration.
Two last questions. One is, now with your background and understanding through all these administrations and all of the questioning that you've done internally, what is your sense of Guantanamo Bay and what should be done about that?
Guantanamo is a blight on our society. Candidate Obama was right to say that that was the case and that he would close it. It is more than lamentable that because of political pressure and some practical considerations, to be fair, but for political pressure, he's been unable to close it.
Political pressure being what?
Well, the Republicans have come up with any number of arguments saying that we can't bring detainees onto American soil. It's too dangerous. I just find that would be laughable were it not so outrageous.
What about the agency itself? What is it saying?
Well, most parts of the national security establishment, most agencies, have wished to and sought to close Guantanamo, I would say, for years and years and years. The practical problems to which I alluded, however, are there are some detainees who will be tortured if they are returned to their countries of origin. By law and morally, we cannot do that. And the Bush administration struggled with this problem too, and so it wouldn't send them back. Cannot. The administrations have been unable to bring these people to American soil for trial. So what do you do with them if Republicans make it impossible to bring them to the soil for detention or trial? We can't try some of them because the evidence that would be used was obtained either by measures that are arguably illegal or obtained through intelligence sources and methods, which, if revealed, would endanger the lives of our sources and our practices. So we're stuck, and no one has been able to figure out what to do. But it is a blight because habeas corpus, I would argue, if one had to choose one practice in Western civilization that is the triumph and foundation of our freedoms, it is habeas corpus, and it is not just made a mockery, it does not exist.
Last thing I want to close with your experience, especially your last few years, if you were going to propose reforms to particularly the CIA, but also into the intelligence world, maybe they're political because of what you were facing from the top levels, what would you propose?
Well, this is one of the distressing points and conclusions that I come to, and I'm afraid I dismay, if not dishearten, people that ask me this issue when it comes up, because the terrifying, frankly terrifying, reality discovery that I made, among many, as I was involved in the war on terror and specifically interrogating this individual about whom I write, is that the laws are in place. We have many laws against torture and how to follow certain procedures to obey the laws as officials in the executive branch. Oversight does exist. Legal staffs know their obligations. Officers take an oath and know our obligations. We don't need more laws. We don't need more regulation. None of it sufficed to stop a half dozen or 10 dedicated, purposeful men from overthrowing all the efforts of thousands of good people over hundreds of years. It didn't suffice. It was very easy. So laws don't answer the problem. And I think the only thing one can do is to bear witness and shed light. And light and knowledge of practices make it harder to do wrong. I think that's the only thing that we didn't do that we could do, because all the other measures had been put in place and were there to protect us, and they failed.
You were clearly disturbed about this. Did you and your colleagues discuss it amongst yourselves? And did you have a sense that others were equally disturbed?
Oh, I knew that many were disturbed. But I will say, during the time I was involved in the interrogation of this individual and was running it or part of it, the work pace is so intense that one doesn't have sessions in which one mulls over issues like this. And also, you receive your orders, and you have to try to do them as best as you can. And you don't argue with your subordinates, gee, you know, I think there's a morally ambiguous position here. And you don't say to your superiors that, really, although you are encouraged and expected to bring your judgment to issues at all times, nonetheless, you have to get on with the job. So there wasn't a lot of hand-wringing discussion during that phase. At headquarters, for years, however, many of us openly discussed the contradictions of our orders from our obligations and what to do about it. And it was, frankly, a frightening time, because to challenge authority led to professional and personal destruction. That's Orwellian.
Our guest is Glenn Carl, and the book he has written is The Interrogator, An Education. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
When we come back, why do voters vote the way they do? Next on the Scholar Circle, stay tuned.
There was no promise made, the part you played, the chance you took. There are no boundaries set the time, and yet you waste it still.
Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Observers call this year's Republican presidential primary race among the most unusual in the country's history, whereby the first three primaries have essentially awarded three different candidates, one of them, Iowa, having flipped from Mitt Romney to Rick Santorum. The changing polls also seem to reflect considerable unpredictability among Republican voters. What do we make of this, and what do we know about voting patterns in general in the United States? Who participates, and what matters when they cast their votes? We're joined by three political experts. Henry Brady is the dean of the Golden School of Public Policy and a professor of political science and public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. He's the author of numerous publications and books, including Voice Inequality, Civic Volunteerism in American Politics, and Letting the People Decide. Andrew Gelman is a professor of political science and statistics and director of the Applied Statistics Center at Columbia University. He has authored numerous books and articles, including Red State, Blue State, Rich State, Poor State, Why Americans Vote the Way They Do. Professor George Lakoff also joins us. He is a professor of linguistics at the University of California, Berkeley. Among his numerous articles and books is Don't Think of an Elephant, also Moral Politics, How Liberals and Conservatives Think in the Political Mind. Henry Brady, why don't we start with you, an overview of electoral participation and how that translates into elections.
The important thing to understand about primaries is that the electorate is really typically pretty small because it's the people who are intense about their parties. It's the partisans, the folks who have strong party identification. In this case, since it's essentially a Republican primary year, it's Republicans and it's the base of the Republican Party. So these are the Tea Party people. These are the social conservatives. These are the libertarians. And we've actually seen candidates representing those various points of view. And so you get people who are very, very intense, care a lot about the issues, and who are really looking to see somebody who can represent their point of view. The net result is sometimes, though, that they can run quite far from the center in worrying more about their point of view than about what will really win the election. Although clearly people are talking about how, in the end, they want to have a candidate who can beat Obama, but that seems to be based upon the notion that the toughest, meanest candidate is the one who's going to be able to beat Obama. It's not quite clear that's true. I would argue that, in fact, somebody a little more centrist like Mitt Romney might be better for the party in terms of beating Obama because he would appeal more to independents. But on the other hand, it's conceivable that somebody like Newt Gingrich, because he's so darn good at framing issues and putting forth his perspectives, that might really appeal to independents who would suddenly say, oh, here's somebody who can really solve some problems and deal with them. But that remains to be seen.
You said the key word framing, which would immediately throw the ball over to George Lakoff, Professor Lakoff.
I agree with Henry, but let me give you some more background to that. The framing has to do with different moral systems that conservatives and liberals have. I've called them strict father and nurturing parent systems because they are very much like family-based systems. And then there are what are called the moderates or independents don't have a different system. They have combinations of both. That is, they're progressive on some issues, they're conservative on other issues. And the way brains work is that the language that is used over and over that they hear all the time activates one of the moral systems in their brain. So if you hear conservative framing and conservative language all the time, and you're partly conservative and partly progressive, and you don't hear well-framed progressive language, what you're going to get is more activation of your conservative viewpoints. And that is the advantage that Gingrich has. Gingrich knows very well how to frame and use language that evokes conservative framing very well. And the conservatives have a major advantage in media and in having spokespeople all over the country who are saying the same thing and have been using this language not just during the election campaigns, but full-time, all the time. And the progressives don't have that. They don't have anything like that kind of system. So there is an advantage that somebody like Gingrich would have over Romney, who could do that better. Obama has recently just started to frame things the way he needs to frame them in order to attract biconceptuals, that is, people who are both progressive and conservative, by activating their progressive frames. And that's something he didn't do very much during his first 3 years in office.
Andrew Gelman, you've talked about why primaries are so hard to predict.
Primaries are much more unpredictable for several reasons. First, as Henry said, the who's actually voting in the primary is itself unpredictable. Turnout can vary a lot. It's going to be a lot different depending on how deep you go into the partisans. And second, the voters are choosing between a bunch of candidates that are very similar in issue stances. And you're hearing a lot about how Gingrich is different than Romney, and Romney was different from Perry. But on the issues, compared to where most Americans stand, they're pretty close to each other. And similarly, there was a lot of passion 4 years ago about Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. But on the issues, the two candidates were almost indistinguishable. So there's not really a compelling reason for a voter to choose one candidate or the other based on the issues. The next thing is there's electability, which is just a complicated thing. As Henry said, it's hard to really know who is more electable. Finally, there are multiple candidates, and when there are many candidates, there's the opportunity, almost the necessity for strategic voting. You don't want to waste your vote on someone who's going to come in third or fourth or lower than that. That creates instability. Someone gets ahead in the polls. Once they're ahead in the polls, it's more rational to vote for them. Once it's more rational to vote for them, they can increase, go higher up in the polls. Then they can get more media attention and they can crash. And we've seen that happen a few times. In an election with only two candidates, you don't see that because there's no reason to vote for someone you don't like just because he's ahead in the polls. When it's a bunch of candidates that are very close to each other, it's going to be harder to do, harder to make that decision. Finally, I think I said finally already, but I'll say finally again, in a general election, you have months to make up your mind. The primary, you have news coming in every couple weeks. And all of a sudden, there's lots of ads, lots of attention. There's not a lot of time to sort of shake out what your deeper feelings might be. So as a result, you get a lot of unpredictability, I think, just the way it is.
So we've had essentially three Republican primary contests with three different results. How might that play out as we go further into this season and then into the generals? Henry Brady, what do you say?
It's not actually that unusual because often the person who wins Iowa is not the person who wins New Hampshire, and then South Carolina is still a different kind of state altogether with, on the one hand, a lot of social conservatives, but on the other hand, actually higher unemployment and a lot more anger and emotion right now. And that's, by the way, an important theme in this election. I think something to really keep track of is that a lot of the voters are very angry. They're very upset. They're looking for somebody who can help them speak that anger and put it out there. And that's one thing they seem to like about Newt Gingrich. I think he's really hit home runs with respect to his criticism of food stamps. Who would have thought that food stamps, which is really just a program to help people who otherwise might not have enough to eat, who would have thought that would have become a central issue in the campaign? Yet Newt Gingrich has done a brilliant job of really painting that as a giveaway by the government and as an indication of the nation going downhill because we're subsidizing people who really don't want to work. That's not a correct characterization of the program, but he's done that brilliantly in his framing, and he's also done extremely well with respect to the issues of the free market and the importance of making sure that we have encumbered and unregulated markets. And so he's really hit home runs in those areas and done very well at it. I think the unpredictability comes from the kinds of things that Andrew was talking about. And I think what's interesting now is it looks like, though, that the Republican Party has found the alternative to Romney. That's going to be Gingrich. That may change, but it certainly looks like now the cast is really narrowing. And so now that makes it tougher for Romney to split the opposition. He's got to really focus on Newt Gingrich. And so it's become very much a two-person contest, with Ron Paul playing the part of the libertarian, sort of interesting candidate. And the media like to have a front runner, of somebody who's challenging the front runner, and then sort of an interesting candidate like Ron Paul who can bring up sort of interesting and odd kinds of ideas, and that makes a, sort of a human interest story.
We've heard the anti-welfare mom campaign before, so this isn't really new, the food stamp politic.
Yeah, but welfare is a different program because it's a program that really more completely supports people And it certainly, in fact, in some of its incarnations, it hasn't been well designed in terms of rewarding people who work. And with welfare reform in 96, it's hard to argue that it doesn't do that now. Food stamps has always been a program that almost all Americans thought was a good idea, because if people don't have enough to eat, they felt that was sort of a minimal kind of thing the government should be doing. And it really, I think, shows that Newt Gingrich seems to have a sense of where the emotions lie with the Republican base right now.
I think emotions are probably key, yes.
This is Andrew Gelman. On one hand, Henry is saying that Gingrich has sort of emerged as the alternative to Romney, and the other alternatives were sort of disqualified for various reasons. And then Henry said that the attack on food stamps was very effective. Could it be that if Gingrich was in the position that he was going to start improving in the polls, and he happened to be talking about food stamps recently, I wonder if it's necessarily correct to attribute his recent success in the polls to the food stamps tack. It may just be that whatever he happened to have been said now would have been caught on.
Well, that's right, but we do know that he got a standing ovation when he put that idea forth. We do know that there's a longstanding current among conservatives in America about being upset about welfare, and that they use criticisms of welfare as a way to be critical of various groups in the population who they think don't have a good work ethic. What's amazing, though, is that Newt Gingrich can get that same kind of traction, I think, with food stamps.
It's not amazing at all.
But I think he is.
George Lakoff?
It's not the least bit amazing. First of all, the voters are not voting on issues in general. People used to think, before Reagan came along, that people voted on issues. And we know from Richard Wirthlin's discussions, who was Reagan's chief pollster and strategist, that people didn't particularly like Reagan's positions on issues. They just wanted to vote for Reagan for a set of reasons. Namely, Reagan talked about values, and people care about moral values. He was connected with people and communicated well. He said what he believed. He was authentic, and therefore they could trust what he was going to do and identify with him. And those are the major reasons that people are voting. And if they're voting on issues, it's that the issues represent certain values. What's happening with food stamps is something that's just about predictable. In the conservative moral system, what's important is individual responsibility, and there is no such thing as social responsibility. The idea is that you are responsible for succeeding, and if you're not succeeding, it's your fault, and you're to be morally blamed for it. And being on food stamps means that you have, failed, and therefore you shouldn't be getting anything, and other people are paying for keeping you alive. And that is something that people who have a strong conservative moral system are very, very much against and have always been. Food stamps is just one example of these things. The old Reagan phony welfare queen thing was another example of it. Food stamps are not about food. They're about moral issues. These moral issues come with issues of emotion. If you're saying that somebody is immoral, then they're disgusting. They're people who feel that there's something wrong with you, and they get angry at you because of it. The emotions are not just pure emotion of some sort or other. They're emotions that tie directly to the structure of that moral system. And Gingrich knows how to exploit that. And he knows how to exploit it especially for people who are biconceptual, who are partly progressive and partly conservative, because he can activate that conservative parts of their brain and, get them emotionally aroused in that, and therefore get it made stronger and make it more likely that they're going to vote conservative rather than progressive.
Yes, Andrew Gelman. Regarding the comment about Reagan having a positive emotional affect, I think that if you're running for president and the incumbent has the economy collapsing, then that and a positive emotional affect is a good thing to have. And if you're running for re-election and the economy is booming, then that and a positive emotional affect is a good thing to have. And I do sort of believe, without any particular evidence, that Obama probably has modeled himself somewhat after Reagan. I have a pet theory that one reason that Obama has not done so much blaming the economy on George W. Bush is because Obama's been trying to have the same positive emotional affect that Reagan had. I don't see any compelling reason to suspect that Reagan's success was due to his positive emotional affect. I think it worked for him, and that was his style, but his popularity arose from the economic success that accompanied his presidency.
What I'd like to do is take this into a broader discussion, and maybe, Henry Brady, you can come back in. We know that there are these framing issues and these emotional issues. Some other theorists also talk about people voting based on just the economy. Can you give us a sense of what generally people are relying on in order to cast their votes?
Well, I think that when we get into the general election, a broader set of concerns are going to come into play. And actually, what will be interesting is to see if Obama tries to appeal on things like the food stamps issue to the notion that we are a community and that we should help others. And indeed, that is a conservative value. Conservatives actually do believe that it's important to help the poor. And if you ask them questions about that, they will say, yes, it's important to be helpful to the poor. So I think there's something he could appeal to conservatives on, and that would be that kind of concern. More generally, in the general election, we know that the economy is a really important variable. It's one of the few things that we as political scientists really think we know something about. And if the economy is doing badly, and it has been doing badly, it's doing better now, but it's still 8.5% unemployment. Ronald Reagan got reelected in 1984 with 7.5% unemployment after a period of really, really bad economic performance, high inflation, high unemployment. But it's not clear Obama is going to get the country down to 7.5%. And in fact, that would be really drawing to an inside straight right now. He'd have to have about a tenth of a point of unemployment decline for every month for the next 10 months or so. And I don't think that's going to happen. I think the best he could possibly hope for would be to maybe get below 8%. And it's not even clear he's going to get there. So economy is going to matter a lot. That's part of the reason people are so angry. Another thing that's going to matter a lot is character. I think there's no question but that people care about the character of people. They care about leadership and intelligence. And on that, I think Barack Obama has a lot of points. I think Newt Gingrich might get points on that dimension as well, because a lot of people think he's a leader and that he's intelligent. I think on honesty and integrity, Newt Gingrich could have problems. Barack Obama has done exceptionally well in that area. There's no real large ethical scandals that surround him right now. So I think on the character issue, Barack Obama has a really good position, and even with respect to Mitt Romney as well. It's because Romney's going to be saddled with the notion that he's this millionaire, billionaire almost, who has not paid a large fraction of his income in taxes, and that therefore that's not fair. And obviously Obama in his State of the Union was really pushing the fairness issue. Fairness, fairness, fairness. And that's clearly going to be one of the great themes he's going to try to push. He's got to push that because, to be honest, pushing the performance of the economy is going to be a very, very tough road for him in terms of getting votes.
Back to what George Lakoff does in terms of the framing issue, the food stamps and the welfare were both issues of fairness. And so here is Barack Obama pushing on the issue of fairness. Before I bring you back in, George Lakoff, what I'd like to also do is try to understand this juxtaposition of what Andrew Gelman did with red state, blue state, rich state, poor state, about how people's finances figure into this. And then I'd like to go back to the actual campaigns. Andrew Gelman, can you walk us through how people's personal economics play into the election?
Our best evidence is that people vote based on what they think is good for the country, not what they think is good for them personally. I think the sort of simple story is the upper income person favoring Republican tax cuts is not favoring them because he wants the $1,000 and thinks it'll be better for him personally. It's more that as an upper income person, it's very natural to think that giving money back to other upper income people will stimulate the economy. And in reverse, lower income people, of course, people are always going to be happy when they get something from the government or from anybody, but fundamentally their reason for supporting Democrats or supporting policies of redistribution is because it seems very natural to them that that would be good for the economy too. That said, the difference between how rich and poor people vote is large but not huge. So people in the upper third of income vote roughly as conservative or as Republican as people from Texas. People in the lower third of income vote about as Democratic as people from Massachusetts. People's votes are not determined entirely from their income, but the rich America versus poor America vote very differently. One thing that we found in our research is that the differences between rich and poor Americans are larger in so-called red states, such as Texas or Mississippi. In the more conservative states in the middle of the country, there are very big differences between how rich and poor vote. But in places like New York and California, rich people and poor people don't vote so differently at all. In places like California and New York, richer people tend to be more liberal on social issues, which counterbalances their economic conservatism. But basically has to do with some of the things that the other panelists have talked about, the interaction between economic and social issues. Economic issues are important and social issues are important, but also economic issues are social issues, because if you don't support welfare because you think it's helping people who are lazy, that's a social issue. And conversely, a lot of attitudes on social issues get framed as, well, I don't like this because why should my tax dollars go to it? And rich and poor people in different parts of the country have different balances of attitudes on economic and social issues.
George Lakoff.
There's a lot of complexity there, as Andrew was saying. But one thing that is usually not discussed is the role of conservative populism in this. Conservative populism is something Democrats tend not to understand because they tend to think in terms just of economics straightforwardly. But a lot of people who are poor vote against their interests when they're conservative. That is, what does that mean? It means they have a conservative moral worldview that has to do with individual responsibility, not responsibility of people for each other. And when that happens, you're going to get people voting on their moral views rather than on their income. Even though if they voted Democratic, they might do very, very better income-wise, they may vote against that simply because they will find Democratic candidates and those programs immoral from their perspective. That, I think, is a big deal. I think when Andrew talks about what's good for the country, the word good there is what's important. Good has to do with a moral system and how you understand what's good morally. And so when Obama comes along and gives you a progressive moral worldview that says this country is about people caring about each other and working together to provide a sense of the public so that we are all empowered and protected equally, that's a very different kind of message than somebody like Romney or Gingrich who comes along and says freedom is about the freedom to do what you want for your own good, period, for your personal responsibility. And if you're not doing well, then you're not disciplined enough to be personally responsible, and therefore you deserve to starve. I mean, this is a very, very different moral worldview and a different view of what's good for the country, because they believe that having personal responsibility as opposed to public responsibility means that it's better for the country that you do that. That gives people incentive to go out and work and get jobs and be entrepreneurs, when that may not be true at all, but that is the way that is understood. And what Gingrich is great at doing is at framing things from that perspective. And Obama has been recently, though not in his first 3 years in office, become very good at framing the progressive position.
Henry Brady, one of the things that I wanted to get into is who participates and who doesn't, and how does that ultimately affect the outcomes of the elections?
Participation takes many forms, and one of the forms of participation that's clearly increasingly important is giving money to campaigns. And with Citizens United, that has really unleashed a whole lot of money from a whole lot of people into super PACs. What you find there is, this is a social science finding worth noting, it turns out the rich give more than the poor. What a remarkable finding, but it's true. And that simple truism translates into the fact that the rich, therefore, through their dollars, through political contributions, can have an enormous impact on elections. Right now, we know that Newt Gingrich was, to some extent, resuscitated by getting a $5 million grant, to a super PAC that supported him, that helped him get his campaign going again, and that was from one donor, from one particular business person who owns casinos in Las Vegas. So that kind of money can have an impact in what's going on. An important thing to know about the Democratic and Republican parties is this. The Democratic Party is much more of a catch-all party. It's more concentrated among lower-income people, but it really goes across the spectrum. The Republican Party is much, much more highly concentrated into the other upper-income brackets, and therefore it makes it easier for them to have one perspective on issues with respect to income taxes and a whole lot of economic issues. And it's a lot harder for a Democratic candidate to have the corresponding opposite views, because the Democratic candidate has to appeal to a much broader array of people. And that's one of the problems the Democrats have right now.
And what about voter turnout? How does that come into determine election results?
Well, certainly voter turnout is a problem in general in America, because a lot of people just don't come out to vote, and we end up with voter turnout of around 50-55% in the typical presidential election, and that means a lot of people who should be voting are not voting. There are differences between those who vote and those who don't vote. Typically, lower-income people are much less likely to vote than upper-income people, and obviously they have different interests.
George Lakoff.
One of the things that isn't really discussed in all of this, as Henry started out by saying, is that the Republican candidates all share a conservative worldview, a conservative morality. And Obama and Democrats in general have a very different view of what the country is about and what morality is. And what you have right now is a huge divide between those who believe that democracy is about citizens caring about each other and creating a notion of the public where people are uniformly empowered and protected. Conservatives view democracy as giving individuals the freedom not to care about other people, but to act on their own self-interest, period, only be responsible for themselves.
This is Andrew Doman. I want to disagree with that slightly, because John Corzine is a Democrat, and I don't think anyone would accuse him of being a very deep, caring person. There's a whole segment of the Democratic Party which represents managerial expertise. So we have Lawrence Summers and people like John Corzine, who doesn't seem like such an expert now, but was presented as one earlier. I think this relates to Henry's point that Democratic Party represents some strongly populist elements. It also represents a lot of Wall Street and gets a lot of funding from Wall Street.
That's right.
Basically, Occupy Wall Street and Wall Street are both full of Democrats, and that creates a lot of complexity.
You're right, because what you have there is what I call biconceptualism. People whose fundamental views are more toward caring about how people work in general. But you also do have people who have taken on the question of how to maximize self-interest. And there are a lot of Democrats who took economics courses or went into business and are into maximizing their own self-interest and the self-interest of others, which is basically part of a conservative perspective, but they see it as a management of the economy for the good of the economy in general. Very much a conservative perspective within the Democratic Party. Corzine and Summers are centrists in that way. And what is a centrist? It's not just somebody who's in the middle. It's somebody who has both views about different issues.
That's a good place to leave it. Gentlemen, thank you so very much. We've been speaking with Dean Henry Brady, Dean of the School of Public Policy and a professor of political science at UC Berkeley. He's author of numerous books, including Voice Inequality and American Politics and Letting the People Decide. Also, we have Andrew Gelman, professor of political science and statistics at Columbia University and author of Red State, Blue State, Rich State, Poor State, Why Americans Vote the Way They Do, as well as Professor George Lakoff, who is professor of linguistics at UC Berkeley, and he is author of books such as Don't Think of an Elephant and Moral Politics, How Liberals and Conservatives Think. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests, and special thanks to Ankina Aghasyan, who produces the show with me. Also, special thanks to Ismail Karim, our assistant producer. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can always go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives. You can keep up with us on thescholarscircle.org or armoodian.com. See you next week.